Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know the horror stories of meth, methamphetamines, meth labs in tumble-down homes. All the way back in 2005, Newsweek had it on the cover as America's most dangerous drug. What most people don't know, and journalist Nick Redding uncovered in Little Olwine, Iowa, is the story behind the epidemic. What drove America to meth? This hour on Point, Nick Redding and Methland. You can join the conversation. Do you know meth up close, personally? How would you explain what it's done? How would you explain why meth moved in? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from St. Louis, Missouri, is journalist and author Nick Redding. He spent years investigating the rural meth epidemic in Olwine, Iowa. Now he's sharing what he learned with remarkable stories and insight. His new book is Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nick Redding, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This is some great book. This is not the Grant Wood kind of Ma and Pa stolid farmers with pitchfork and barn that you found in Olwine. But you didn't exactly go in with a chip on your shoulder. This is kind of home country for you, more or less.
Yeah, it is. I mean, half my family is from Iowa and the other half is from Missouri. And, you know, my dad's family is all from a little town up on the Minnesota border in Iowa. So it's not foreign country necessarily at all.
And in fairness, it's not even just Olwine or just the Midwest where you started kind of smelling the fumes of methamphetamines. You describe right at the beginning of the book, Nick, how your reporting was taking you all over the country from Idaho to you name it, coast to coast, and meth just kept showing up.
It did. The first place I ran across it back in 1999 was in a little town in the Idaho desert called Gooding. And when I say little, I mean 1,200 people. And I had no idea what it was. I just knew that when I tried to get the girl at the motel to rent me a room one night, she was so distracted by painting her three children's fingernails kind of over and over and over again and that she could barely rent me a room. And she had all these open sores on her arms The room she did finally rent me kind of stunk like ether and had big burn marks on the floor, which is, you know, I later found out that's kind of the hallmark of a small-time meth cooking in the motel.
She was up to it. You found it there, and pretty soon you were running across it everywhere. I mean, somewhere you or somebody in the book describes this as the most American drug.
Yeah, and that comes from something that I read by a former Harvard sociologist who puts meth in the context of the notion of hard work. And what I mean by that is that it's a drug that you don't have to eat, you don't have to sleep, you don't have to hydrate. And so if you're somebody who does hard and particularly repetitive labor like meat packing or long-haul trucking or farm work, it's a drug that can be sort of useful. It's the drug of double shifts. And so, you know, being that work is sort of this national kind of mania and a huge part of our identity, meth goes along with that.
You can be cranked and still doing the double shifts. Of course, you describe how in a lot of cases the double shifts went away, and you make very plain right off the bat, Nick, that a lot of Americans really have no idea what's going on in the middle of this country, that there's a kind of mom and apple pie iconography that still hangs over the region where you found something very different and much more disturbing going on.
Yeah, and you know, I think the thing that I found and that growing up I always sort of understood, but, you know, I think it's... you know, I left when I was 18, and I'm not sure how much anybody, I'm not sure how much I noticed about where I grew up when I was 18. But coming back very often, you know, there is this notion that everything will perpetually be okay in the place that most Americans came out of before they started moving to the coasts en masse, and that what we left behind needs to be perpetually okay because it's kind of the principal part of our history. The fact is, a small town America is increasingly impoverished and has been for 30 years. And the association of drugs with poverty, I believe, is one that people on both sides of the battle will always be willing to put together. But what they're not willing to admit in many cases is that small town America is on the verge of bankruptcy.
Or sometimes, and often even, deep in it. We're hearing from listeners on Facebook right now as we speak, Nick. Here's a Greg in Iowa, I guess. He says, living in Iowa, you had to be careful when you went into the woods or picking wild asparagus in the ditches because you could accidentally stumble onto a place where meth lab's material were dumped. I know firemen who had to let a house burn because they found out it was a meth lab. It was too dangerous to go in. I wish you'd read a little bit from Methland, Nick. You've got an amazing scene where one of these characters, Roland Jarvis, in Oland, Iowa, he's high on crack here, convinced that police are about to discover his home meth lab, throws chemicals down the drain, lights a cigarette. The fire is instantaneous. It's intense. Instead of running out of his house, he runs back in. Can you read for us from Methland, Nick Redding?
Sure. Jarvis says he wanted to save the house. It's considered a foregone conclusion by the police that he was trying to retrieve the remnants of his meth lab, along with the formidable amount of dope that he had been making. For Jarvis, in a town full of meth cooks, was considered one of the finest and most prolific of their number. That, or he was attempting to spread the fire himself in order to burn as much evidence as possible. It's conceivable, too, that he was in such a state of psychotic disarray, emotional bankruptcy, and physical disembodiment that he was trying to do all three of those things. What stopped him, in any event, is that he began to melt. Following one of his trips outside, Jarvis looked down and saw what he thought was egg white on his bare arms. It was not egg white. It was the viscous state of his skin now that the water had boiled out of it. Jarvis flung it off himself, and then he saw that where the egg white had been, he could now see roasting muscle. He looked at his legs and his abdomen. His skin was dripping off his body in sheets. Panicked, standing there in the frigid night outside the inferno of his mother's home, naked but for his boxer shorts, which he'd inadvertently soaked in water while fighting the fire, Roland Jarvis began pushing sheets of skin from himself, using his hands like blunt tools, wiping and shoving the hide from as much of his body as he could reach. He'd have pulled the melting skeins of skin from himself in bigger, more efficient sections, but for the fact that his fingers had burned off his hands. His nose was all but gone now, too, and he ran back and forth among the gathered neighbors, unable to scream, for his esophagus and his voice box had cooked inside of his throat. The police, says Jarvis, just watched. Jeremy Logan was still a sergeant and a man with whom Jarvis had gone to high school. When Jarvis approached him, Logan moved away like a matador avoiding a bull, not because he took sadistic pleasure in Jarvis's plight, but because, as Logan later told me, no one knew what to do. Jarvis begged in vain for someone to shoot him. He was burning alive and the pain was unbearable. Not even the paramedics knew how to respond, says Jarvis. He says everyone watching, the gathered neighbors, the police, the entire Old Wine Fire Department, wanted him to die. And I don't blame them, he says. What else could you do with a man like me?
Nick Redding reading from his book, Methland. It's powerful, and there's a lot more. We'll look at what's behind it. We've got callers, Columbia, South Carolina. Adam, you're on the air with Nick Redding.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I go to USC in Columbia, but I'm from a small town in South Carolina of about 1,800 people.
Uh-huh.
And there's actually a pretty big meth problem. It's a very rural town. I mean, like I said, there's only 1,800 people, but my sister actually got tangled up in it, and it's like it's really tearing a lot of families apart. And what I've seen personally is, even since my sister's cleaned up, it's like she's traded vices. It seemed like it really took such a strong hold on her that she just can't, you know, kick it. I mean, she doesn't use meth anymore, but it's like something else. You know, she's trading off. And I just thought it was interesting that you were talking about small town America, because I mean, that was where I was born and raised.
And hard to break it there. Hard to break it, Adam, because so much, too much of the town is involved in it?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. I mean, it was, you know, her and her boyfriend and all their circle of friends. And then, I mean, you go 5 minutes outside the town, which only has 2 stoplights anyway. And, I mean, it's like everyone does it, you know. I mean, inside the town, you got really Christian families. But, I mean, the further out you get, it's just like it runs rampant. And it's pretty bad. I mean, there's been, like, shacks exploding from I guess bad mixtures. I'm not sure how it works, but it's just pretty bad, you know. And she went through a program to get off of it, but like I said, I mean, now she uses alcohol, and it just seems like it's interesting that you guys talk about it, because it's pretty bad in my town. And there's a lot of kickback, like in schools and high schools, a lot of kids are around it, and you can tell that they've been around it for a while because it affects how they are.
Adam, we hear it loud and clear. Nick Redding's book speaks to it deeply in Olwine, Iowa. You're reporting there from South Carolina, and we'll dive right in. Exploding shacks, Nick, and a very familiar sound, what we're hearing from Adam, sadly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about America's meth epidemic and its roots and its consequences for one small Iowa community. Our guest is Nick Redding, journalist and writer, author of Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. It's a powerful book about Olwine, Iowa. Nick, I want to get to you on Adam from South Carolina, but let's get one more here first from Susan, Concord, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Just coincidentally, in yesterday's New York Times, there was an article about the incredibly pernicious effects from residue where there have been meth labs in homes, and they highlighted the story of a family where for months they didn't know what was going on. They moved into this home. Their children got severe respiratory problems, and both adults had major kidney problems. And it took months to discover that this was from the residue of meth labs that evidently permeates the ducts, the walls themselves, the rugs, the floors. And there are thousands of these homes.
We saw it. It was compelling to think, even after maybe the lab shut down, move in next, and you still got the meth trouble. Thanks for raising that, Susan. Nick, I mean, you've got powerful accounts in here in your book as well. I mean, you've got this toddler named Buck who was
right.
Eventually taken from his parents' control by the Human Services Department in Iowa. Had his hair cell follicles had the highest traces of methamphetamine in state history. I wish you'd take us sort of from the shack, the home, the house, and its sort of permeation with meth right on out in the circles to the community. Nick, I mean, start in the home. What happens there? Not everybody knows how this works. What goes on there? And then trace it on out to the town of Olwine, if you would.
What goes on in the making of the drug?
Yeah.
And also to the
and
to
the family
callers.
That's living in the midst of the making.
Yeah. Well, you know, small-time meth batching depends on chemicals that are easily accessible, and the number one ingredient is pseudoephedrine. Pseudoephedrine is what goes into cold medicine, hence the name Sudafed.
Mm. And hence the requirement that we sign for it these days when you buy it at the pharmacy.
Right, and which we can get to later, because mm-hmm. that unfortunately doesn't do much good. But in any event, with pseudoephedrine and anhydrous ammonium, which is a nitrous compound that farmers spray on their fields,
mm-hmm.
and things like hydrochloric acid or denatured alcohol, all things that are available pretty readily at the pharmacy or the farm co-op or whatever, meth can be made. to the caller's point from Concord, Massachusetts, the meth, when it's cooked or rendered, has an effect that's a little bit like dioxin. You remember the dioxin scare back in the 1980s, and people were getting sick. But meth fumes sort of have an ability to adhere to things, whether it's the surfaces in the kitchen or whether it is something like your lung tissue. And this effect is one that goes on for a while. It doesn't go away. It's hard to get rid of. And so that's part of the problem in these homes that used to be meth labs, is that they're still essentially sort of toxic sites, you know. There's a lot of evidence that people who dismantle meth labs, you know, police officers and things like that, anecdotally have high instances of illness. Also, in the event that somebody does cook their meth wrong, there's a number of bad things that can happen inside your house. You might end up releasing phosphine gas, which is can cauterize parts of your internal organs. It's so toxic and hot. This is a fairly common thing that has to be bled off while cooking meth. The other thing is that if you happen to blow your house up, then all the smoke that's coming out of there all smoke is bad smoke. This is really bad smoke, you know. So that's, you know, from the kitchen sink to the potential of in the town, it's bad.
And there's the literal chemistry of methamphetamines. It's the sort of family and social and economic chemistry that you're really digging toward here. I mean, describe for us, you know, what it does to the family in that house, what it does to the town. In this case, Olwine took it from A to Z.
Yeah, and you know, the quote that I always come back to is the reason that I went to Olwine is I was reading in archives of the Des Moines Register, and this doctor up in Olwine, who turns out to be the main character or one of two main characters in the book, described meth as a socio-cultural cancer. And when I called him, I didn't have any idea what that meant, but I thought it sounded awfully smart. And you know, what his name's Dr. Clay Hallberg, and what Clay meant was that you know, when there's a drug problem in a place like Olwine, or anywhere for that matter, but particularly where the cost of things cannot be absorbed as easily as they can in, let's say, Los Angeles, which also has a big meth problem, it affects everyday life on many levels, and one of the outcomes is economic, certainly. One of the outcomes is emotional across a community basis, like the fellow who just called in from South Carolina, where, you know, what he describes in part is the idea that a lot of people down there are upset and don't know what to do. Well, 15 years of that really wears on the psychic health of a community.
We heard you read about psychotic disarray in your sort of appalling description of the burning of Roland Jarvis. But is it psychotic disarray brought on by meth? Is it psychotic disarray that predates the meth? You know, which comes first here?
Well, you know, I think that that's a great question, and one of the answers to that question is what is scary about meth, which is that, as one neuropharmacologist told me at the University of Toronto, it'll be 30 years before we know the answer to that, because the research is still fairly nascent. But, you know, as far back as the 1940s, the American government was issuing warnings about the use of methamphetamine that included this long list of things like satanic thoughts and sexual perversion and morbid depravity. I mean, all these kind of, they sound a little bit funny and a little bit quaint at this point, but they're not. You know, one of the most logical answers that I ever heard to your question is that the simple sleep deprivation alone will make you crazy.
Sleep deprivation of meth, but you're describing all kinds of deprivation that really comes before the full meth blossom. I mean, you've pretty much laid down your own theory of the case here, that there was an economic and cultural breakdown that tore the hole in the social fabric that invited meth in.
Yeah, and in that way, I believe that in some ways this is not a story about meth. I think that meth is the lens that sort of allowed me to take a look at the contributing factors to, you know, how it is that meth moved into that vat. I mean, because you have to say, okay, how did it get here? What are the reasons? And to me, the principal reasons are economic. Again, you know, we go back to the simple postulate that most people accept that drugs follow poverty. Well, I, like everybody else 5 years ago, didn't associate poverty with the rural United States. Thanks to some big changes in industry, it is, in fact, an increasingly impoverished place. So meth moves in.
Let's get a couple calls, and then we're going to hear from a friend of yours, straight from Olwine, a big actor there. Let's go to Sarah in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to attest to the fact that this drug is very quickly can devastate a community. I come from a very, very rural part of Arkansas. There's just a little over 900 people in the town where I was raised. And, you know, I left for college and stayed away for a few years, came back, and the town was like a ghost town. People that I had a lot of respect for who were addicted to this drug, people, I would say over half the town living on some kind of assisted help from the government, who don't work and who are addicted to this drug. And it works very quickly on your community, and it has devastating effects. And when you do live in these rural parts of the country where you already are in a place where you don't have a lot of access to, government help or what the cities might have to offer, it's really devastating.
You went away to college, came back, and it was a ghost town hollowed out by meth. And your town is not the only one. I want to bring into the conversation right now from Olwine, Iowa, where Nick Redding sat down for several years looking more and more closely at meth and what lay behind it. Nathan Leon, he is assistant attorney for Fayette County, which includes the town of Olwine, Iowa, has prosecuted hundreds of cases involving meth in the adult and juvenile courts there. At the peak of Olwine's meth problem, he estimated that 95% of his caseload was related to the drug. He was among the first couple of people that Nick Redding met in Olwine, Iowa. Nathan Leon, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
Hi. You just heard Sarah describe how her hometown in Arkansas just exploded with meth, seemed to her like overnight. How did it seem to you? When did you realize what was erupting under you there in your hometown?
Honestly, I think it was probably when I first arrived back and took my new role, and that would have been early 2002. I was back in the area.
You'd gone off to law school in Indiana, I think, Nathan.
That's correct, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back, when I took the job, we had a new police chief that had been appointed by the mayor just before me. And when Wayne Saar, the county attorney, asked me to come back and be his assistant in Fayette County, it was definitely a problem. But it didn't seem like it really, crescendoed and got to that really raging point until about 2003 through 2005 is when I would estimate our caseload really peaked with the methamphetamine activity.
And that is the same window of time that Nick Redding showed up. He's dug in really deep. How does it feel, Nathan Leon, to have your town, I have to say, very expertly sort of dissected by a journalist of the seriousness of Nick Redding? But, I mean, you knew and know, I suppose, most of what he's writing about here, but still in black and white, it's something to read.
It is, and it's hard to take a look at yourself. It's hard to take a look at your town in that black and white. It's almost like looking in a mirror and say, you know, where were we? And how did, you know, both I, the way I was reacting in 2005, you know, my personal life and in how I was dealing with things are so much different than they are today. But yes, you're right. It's very difficult, especially in the Midwest, to look at yourself in those black and white terms. When those words are staring back at you at the page, you just say, oh, my. And
it was a pretty deep, dark, ugly hole there. Let's get a call from Nashville and look at how this happens, why this happens. We'll bring it to you, Nathan, and Nick Redding. Philip, in Nashville, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want, you know, I live in Nashville now, but I actually grew up in a small town in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, not to be really political, but it's almost like these small towns are what Sarah Palin called real America. And I think what it is that when I was growing up, we used to just cruise the streets, the main thoroughfare, just back and forth, and maybe get drunk drinking or smoking cigarettes. And now it seems that the kids are more bored, I guess, because they don't get to cruise, or the city police have stopped that. There's no real activity, and there's nothing to do in these small communities. I almost think it's more of a boredom thing. They're looking for some way to escape where they are because financially they can't do that.
They can't get out. They're bored where they are. Nick Redding, boredom, how deep does that go? I mean, unspool further what you found is sort of the why of this.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not sure. Lori Arnold, who was this, you know, sort of a principal trafficker in Iowa, in one of her letters to me, we would go back.
This is the sister of the actor Tom Arnold, the husband of Roseanne Barr, sort of a famous son out of Olin, Iowa. This is his sister. She was a big trafficker.
She was in actually in Ottumwa, Iowa.
Right, Ottumwa.
But the groundwork that she laid down there certainly affected what was going on in Old Wine and what was going on in a large portion of the Midwest, in fact. But in any event, in one of her letters, you know, she said, we'd go back and forth, and I would say, well, this is kind of what I'm finding, and here's the argument that I'm putting together. And in some ways, in these letters that she would send to me from federal prison just down the road here from St. Louis, in fact, really, it was kind of a sounding board for me, and I would, you know, go into these economic things and mm-hmm. reasons, and what Lori would say was, well, boredom had a lot to do with it. You know, there just wasn't much to do. Now, to me, I don't see it as boredom. I see it when there's not a lot to do, it's because there's fewer jobs. You know, there's fewer places to spend money. There's just less money around. The town doctor, Clay Hallberg, said that, you know, you're in a bad place if you can't go see the band play on Saturday night. And what he meant was that, you know, when businesses go out of business and people can't go out and have fun, that's a big problem. I mean, it's very simple, but that was one of his real points.
Nathan, the economy got very bad. The meatpacking plant closed up, and there was kind of a great sucking sound. It pulled hard on your town, Old Wine.
That's correct, Tom. We lost approximately 2,000 jobs from the early 80s to the early 2000s. And, you know, we're talking about a town of approximately 7,000 people, and we're talking 2,000 jobs.
Wow.
It was increased globalization. We lost the railroad, which is now making a resurgence. The meatpacking, there were some other manufacturing plants, Donaldson's and some other things, that just left due to the global forces, in part described by Nick in his book.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's meth epidemic and its roots and its consequences for one small Iowa community. Nick Redding is here. He's author of the new book, Methland, a very powerful account. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, a powerful account of what happened to Old Wine, Iowa, a town of 6,000 or 7,000 that got hit very hard, and it is hardly alone. Nathan Leon is with us from Old Wine, Iowa. He's assistant attorney for Fayette County, includes Old Wine. He was right in the thick of it. Let's get a call right here from Hollywood, Florida, and Rex. Hi, Rex. You're on the air with Nathan Leon and Nick Redding. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me on the show. I just wanted to share with you that I was a meth user about 30-some-odd years ago in the mid-70s in Memphis,
way back.
Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, way back. You know, you're looking for the answer to how this gets started and everything, and my own personal experiences are from dysfunctional families and a lack of fabric in society and the strength of the family unit. You know, I was a young kid, 14 years old, shooting bucks in Memphis. And to see this happening today in American small town is not a surprise to me. I see this happening across America because of the things you're stating in the show. No jobs, economy, but we got to get back to, you know, some of those things that create those situations, and that's family and fabric in society. It's falling apart, and we see it every day.
Rex, let us pick it straight up. And Nick, I mean, you look at families, and you've got families in big trouble in this book. At the same time, you draw the lines right out from there. There's a portion early on where you say, look, this story, you know, stretched all the way from Olwine, Iowa, to the Czech Republic in Iowa and Washington. And it wasn't just about addicts and prosecutors and, I guess, not even families, but about congresspeople and governors and the UN officials and macroeconomists and microbiologists and huge drug
and
companies.
And Marvin the Martian.
Well, I mean, draw it on out. I mean, Rex says the families are falling apart, and that's the reason why. You put them at the middle of a great big web. Paint it for us.
Well, you know, there was a lot of what happened with the meth thing is that the pharmaceutical industry was very good at blocking legislation by DEA that would have made manufacturing meth much more difficult. At the same time, because this meatpacking in America was conglomerating in a way that allowed for large numbers of illegal immigrants to come and work in meatpacking plants all throughout the Midwest. Mexican drug trafficking organizations were able to map distribution routes for methamphetamine and cocaine and heroin onto immigration routes. Those are two big parts of the story. Quickly in response to Rex, one thing I would say that, you know, this is also a book about, it's predominantly a book about how the town of Olwine was able to bring itself back. One thing that I would say is that, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's kind of about the fact that if you're not willing to pay an honest dollar to somebody for an honest day's work, an increasing number of people are going to make their living dishonestly. You can't expect Olwine or towns like it to perpetually pull themselves up by their bootstraps if you're also constantly lowering the sky on their head. Mm. You don't give them room to stand up, they can't do it. Olwine was able to. It's a sort of miraculous story, I think, one that I'm still constantly amazed by. But we're going to be in trouble again at a family level, at a community level, at a government level, if we don't talk about honestly about where this problem comes from.
Nathan Leon, what was your conclusion about where this problem came from? And then we want to turn to how you pushed back against it. I mean, Nick points to globalization. That's a pretty big thing to push back for a little tiny town like Olwine to push back against. But did you see that as you waded into this as part of the problem for you, your town?
It is, and it's part of a multidisciplinary approach that the town has really used. We have to create opportunities. Olwine had to find its way in a global economy, and we had to turn the corner. It's just one of the new challenges faced by Olwine or, you know, countless towns from Idaho to Georgia in trying to find a way to compete with towns of 7,000 in China or Brazil or Europe. Yeah. That's just the model that we're under right now. What we did is we brought in high-tech jobs. We brought in upper-level manufacturing jobs. We built a community college campus in the town. So our our town children and the surrounding area, they can get their associate in arts degree the same day that they can they graduate from high school. That's the way we're combating it. We're combating it with education, with opportunity, with aggressive law enforcement, and we're trying to obviously lobby legislators and both local and national, as big a project as that is, to try to address some of the social fabric that the caller was talking about.
You've got a pharmaceutical company now in the old Tyson meatpacking plant there that makes what cancer oncology products out of pig ears. Is that right?
That's correct. Pork and beef byproducts. And it's really interesting. You know, Tyson didn't want to sell that plant to another food manufacturing because they didn't want to have competition. You know, coming from the mm-hmm. town that they had just in my terms, abandoned. And Abraxas came along and said, you know, that's precisely the kind of plant that we can retrofit and move into and produce those kinds of products.
I've got a lot of people writing in here. Here's, I guess, from Salt Lake City. I'll never forget the sunny autumn day in 2002 when our Salt Lake City street had to be evacuated while police hazmat crews and bomb squads closed in on the meth lab in the house behind us. The tenants had gone so far as to booby-trap their property with, among other things, buried pipe bombs. I mean, it sounds like Iraq, Nick Redding, but things get crazy when it takes hold.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a story when I was reporting this book, and again, it's not something that people think about when they think about a small town, but down in Ottumwa, Iowa, you know, Laurie Arnold's town, where, you know, some guy mid-afternoon on a Tuesday came walking down the street with a shotgun shooting at anybody who or anything that moved. And he was, you know, high on meth. You know, Nathan certainly knows about the difficulties of the labs that at one point they were getting up there and that they're no longer getting because the town has kind of done the unthinkable and come back so much.
Not easy to do. Let's go to Judy in Nashville, Tennessee. Judy, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think about
my
all this, Judy?
Yeah. Well, I think we're lacking personal responsibility. I'm hearing about globalization, and I'm hearing about immigration taking our jobs, and yet I'm not hearing about people taking personal responsibility, spending less, saving more, buying houses that they can afford, driving cars that they can afford.
It's a good point, and we'll pick it straight up, Judy. Let me just hold that thought and go to Fairfield, Vermont, and Laura before we do. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention the whole piece of boredom. I'm intrigued by the role that plays in this conversation because, you know, and I don't mean to dismiss the political or the economic or the sociological parts of this question, and I'm no authority on, you know, meth or any drugs. I guess what I am concerned about is that whole issue of boredom, and that seems to present itself in so many discussions today. It's the whole concept of externals. And our kids are so focused on externals, and we remove those, and what happens? And I raised my kids in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We're talking remote,
mm-hmm.
very remote. And we were really thrust on ourselves to invent and to tap into their curiosities and to cultivate their imagination. There wasn't a lot of externals, and thank God. Because my kids, I think, have a good sense of who they are, and that by cultivating and prizing that internal world, you can be anywhere. You're not then dependent on the externals.
We've got personal responsibility question on the table then, this issue of an interior life. And where was that? Let me get one more, and we'll take it back to Nick and Nathan. Jack in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air, Jack.
Hi, Tom, and thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Yeah, this stuff is really pernicious, and it's really into rural America and rural South Carolina now. I'm afraid, though, that the idea that globalization and the loss of economic opportunity in small towns and in rural America is a contributing factor, I think, but there are an awful lot of idle people And boredom factor comes into this because if they couldn't get meth, they'd just move on to something else. I mean, there's so many drugs out there, and there's so much availability now. And also, regionally here, I think the days of the small-time meth lab have kind of gone away. It seems to be an awful lot of imported stuff that is coming in from Mexico, and I'm sure the organized crime is involved in it. And I don't mean to sound anti-immigrant, but it did seem to correspond with the increase in immigration from Mexico over the past 5 or 10 years.
Jack, we've got a lot to look at right there. Let us jump in. Nick and Nathan, you heard Judy say, where's personal responsibility here? You know, what's with all the griping about globalization? Laura saying, where are the interior lives of people who are turning to such a destructive drug instead of having, you know, resources in themselves? And then Jack kind of wondering if there's a sort of addictive personality that would go anyway. Nick, how do you respond to that line of thinking?
Well, I mean, my response to the personal responsibility part would be to say that there are plenty of people that would like to get quit of methamphetamine, but in places that have falling tax revenues, the idea of treatment is a little bit of a pipe dream. There are no facilities that are available because any excess, there is no excess money. Any money that is available is either being put to, stanching the hemorrhaging of basic services.
Judy might say, what about the personal responsibility not to go to meth in the first place? Is that reasonable? Is that too harsh? How do you end up seeing it?
Well, I think that, people are always going to be you're never going to get rid of the idea that somebody's going to go get drunk or use meth or something like that. The real question here is what proportion of people are going to do that. And there is an increasing proportion of people. I don't think that the notion of boredom in the world has increased in the last 30 years. But the disproportion of income certainly has. So, I don't know that.
Nathan, let me come to you on this this issue of an interior life. I mean, Olwine is not a place that didn't have any fortitude. You grew up, I'm reading here from Nick, on a 480-acre farm. Your parents' farm raised livestock there. You know, this is a county where you had, Amish on the roads, for heaven's sakes. I mean, what happened to the interior life, the interior, strength, fortitude of Olwineites, if that's what you call them, that made them vulnerable here to this?
Well, I think it's a combination of everything that the callers are describing and what we've talked about previously. I think another dynamic to it is that what I have seen from my personal experience, is that there's a mental health component there too. And when you push people to despair, when you push people to say, well, there's nothing going on, or, I mean, you can use the word boredom if you want, you can use a variety of words for that. What happens is that they become more vulnerable and their interior fortitude is broke down. Another caller back when we were talking on Iowa Public Radio pointed out that a lot of the times people first started using meth when they were intoxicated on alcohol. So you have a variety of things that are able to break down maybe some of that interior fortitude, especially, idle hands, idle time, and then maybe a dual diagnosis of both substance abuse and mental health. And it doesn't take very long for a problem like methamphetamine to really grab hold and flower up and rear its ugly head like it did.
Nick, we've got a note here online from Pam, lives in rural Idaho, worked in a job that hired prison crews, 90% of whom were there for meth problems. And she says we should give some attention to what Jack mentioned, that it's not so much small-time production now, but it's, the pushback has driven meth production to Mexico. She says this has served to create a change in meth production. Trafficking has made it very violent and dangerous. No effect on those who consume meth. We still have as many here, but now it's added to gang-type violence. Do you see that, Nick Redding?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, down in Ottumwa, there were traffickers who were following the local police around and following them in as they did their daily errands,
intimidating them,
yeah, do not quit your investigation of certain cases, because we We know what your wife does every day. We know what your children do every day. This is Ottumwa, Iowa. I mean, and even I, after 5 years of this, am saying, this is Ottumwa or Olwine. You know, I mean, and that did not happen in Olwine, but it's sort of astounding. But, you know, that's the really serious component of this. Is the large scale trafficking?
Are we turning the corner on this then, Nick, or not? We just got under a minute left here, but I mean, you see, Olwine is having made a kind of comeback here. The story's not over yet, but as a country, where are we in the arc that you richly begin to describe here?
Well, you know, I think where we are in the arc is yet again, I think we're at a moment where we can choose to be honest about some really essential and difficult things, and one of those, frankly, is immigration in terms of what it does to our economy, not just in Olwine, but all over, and in terms of drug trafficking. But if we're not going to talk about it honestly, then we're just going to be right where we are perpetually.
It's a hard book and a deep book, ultimately a rich book. Nathan Lehan in Olwine, Iowa, the heart of it. We wish you luck with your further comeback, and we appreciate your being with us today, Nathan. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Nick Redding, thanks for all your great journalism and a rich description of a serious problem in the book Methland. Nick, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much, Tom.
It's been great having you. Listeners, thank you for joining us. Good luck wherever you are. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.